Hi everyone, my name is Shona Lane. I'm Education Officer here at the Western Plains Cultural Centre. Joining me is Andrew Glossop, Manager.
Hello.
Kent Buchanan, Curator.
Hello.
Assistant Curator Caroline Edwards.
Hello.
And Jessica Mora, Collections Officer.
Hi.
Today we will be reflecting on Icon and Archive, Photography and the World Wars, an Australian War Memorial travelling exhibition currently on display in the main gallery. In particular, we will be discussing the reliability of photographs prompted by the works of Frank Hurley included in this exhibition. Renowned World War I and World War II photographer Hurley created a number of iconic photographs through composition. These became significantly controversial and raised questions about truth and reliability in the photograph. So to kick off our discussion, was Frank Hurley trying to show man the true nature and horror of war, or was he a showman, heightening the drama for effect through staged and manipulated photographs?
Look, I'm going to be really boring and sit on the fence, and I'm going to say that he was probably both. I think that he was trying to depict in his own mind what was the true horror of war. And perhaps the fact that he felt the need to manipulate photographs is almost an admission on his part that the camera was not up to the task that it had been set. Perhaps in the sense that maybe painting would have been.
Yeah, I think he was clearly working within a tradition that painters had previously worked in. That you know, certainly if you look at the large battle pictures by Lambert in the War Memorial, they were produced over a long period of time, in most cases after the war had ended, and would have been made up of composite images from Lambert's experiences. So I think that you're right that we weren't able to depict particular scenes from the war with just one picture, that we couldn't cram everything into the picture frame, that it necessitated that we were able to draw particular things in to make the message come across the way it was wanted to be done.
I think with Hurley, he probably stands alone in the sense that war photography up until that period had been quite stark and quite overtly realistic. For example, Matthew Brady during the Civil War, and the photos during the Crimea were of victims of war. They were dead bodies, they were battlefields after a war. Whereas Hurley could easily have chosen to do that with the First World War, but he instead rather chose to go with an emotional experience, the emotional experience of war. So rather than them being overly graphic, he's manipulated them to heighten the emotional experience of looking at the images and how we understand war. So in that sense, I think it's probably a very interesting departure for photography, the history of photography, in the sense that it's making a conscious decision that photography could be objective and it could be detached from the person, but it could also be a very emotional, very raw experience emotionally, not just what it is depicted, but how it's been constructed to create a story or a narrative.
What implications does that have for the historical value of the photograph?
Well, from my point of view, I think that it does nothing to diminish the historical value of the photograph. It may not be a true-to-life accurate portrait of that battlefield at that time, but that doesn't diminish anything of its value, because it is a record of what someone was feeling, someone was experiencing during that war, and attempting to place it into a society in a time that was trying to come to terms with what this war meant and how to rationalise it. So I think as a historical document, whether it's been manipulated or not, it's still incredibly valuable.
I think it also feeds into, a kind of a culture that surrounds war. I don't think that there is any way of really communicating and being historically accurate or truthful about things that happen in war. If you go to the War Memorial, it is about remembering, and it's about the stories that the soldiers told. Certainly photography runs throughout that, but it's as much about talking about war rather than, getting right to the heart of war. I think that by the time Hurley came around, we'd certainly got to know photography as a medium. And I think, that it was 30 years or whatever into the life of photography, and it was becoming evident that we could use it in such a way that we could present the images that that we felt encapsulated an experience of a particular battle or the war generally.
I think that it's also looking at a very major thing in historical thought, is that the notion of truth. You know, we tend to think of history as some sort of search for truth, and yet, you know, the more, you know, if you go to university or the further on you go in studying history, the further and further away you actually get from anything that is truth. You know, if we look at it in terms of documentary evidence, yeah, you know, we can get treaties or we can get letters, and we know, say, we can look at a letter coming from a young Queen Elizabeth to her father, Henry VIII. We know that she wrote those words, but we've got no idea as to whether she meant them, whether it was what she really was heartfelt. We know that we've got, you know, soldiers running over the battlefield, but we don't really know what's going through their mind. You know, there's a whole bunch of things that we can never know about history. And I think part of, you know, that one of the questions you asked there was almost this confusion as that, you know, history is about truth. And, you know, maybe it is, but it's a very personal truth that almost becomes meaningless. So if we look at those paintings by Lambert, they were his truth. They were what he felt and what he thought needed to be told about that campaign. It may not have been another person's truth.
And that's exactly right for Hurley. Those images that he has created are his truth about war. And I think, unfortunately, I mean, maybe positively for Hurley as well, the reason why we still look at his images and we still question them and talk about them and debate them, and the reason they've become so iconic, is because they exist in a world where we expect pure objective truth, and they're an exact example of it's not. So they, for the average person looking at them, will always raise that question about, but it's a photograph, is it truth, but is it art? So if it was a painting of that same scene, it may not have had the resonance that it still has today.
I think, Hurley was working within the war machine, and that machine, you know, controlled what we saw, what we were to believe in terms of that war. Obviously, the most graphic images that we see of a war are going to disturb us and maybe make us rise up, and certainly the Vietnam War is an example of that. The more imagery we saw of that war, the more people felt that it was wrong. And therefore you saw the rise of, peace movements, etc. So it fitted within a system of control.
With it, I think that's true. And, I mean, that is a lesson that was learnt, but it was learnt very slowly, even by, you know, what one called the US war machine. In the first Iraq war, there was certainly a lot more freedom of information in terms of imagery that was coming out of that, and to the second Iraq war, where, you know, nobody saw anything that was not, first of all, passed by the army censors. And that's, you know, it's an interesting comment, I suppose, on, even though, you know, we know that these images can be manipulated, what I would say is still the visceral truth of the photograph, no matter what we know can be done to it. And everyone acknowledges that.
And I think the important thing to remember too is that when, you know, those photos served their purpose. You know, when people first saw Hurley's photos, they would have believed them. You know, they wouldn't have questioned them, and it would have done the job that that they intended for them to do. And essentially, you had people who weren't questioning what was happening over there. Now we live in a time where we see images, strange, furry, kind of green images of soldiers in the Middle East. And to my mind, those kind of images, there's less clarity. It would appear as if there could be any kind of manipulation happening in those images, but still they're seen as truth. And we really have no idea whether that's true or not. And certainly the war machine has held back a lot of stuff that they don't want us to see.
Okay, the last question we'll think about in regard to truth and photography is why there is an expectation in regard to photographs that they absolutely portray reality.
I think from photography's very beginnings, it was seen as a scientific mechanical process that was somewhat detached from the person taking the photograph and the subject matter. There was a process happening in between that we didn't necessarily see and we didn't participate in. So I think that people from the very beginning thought of it as being very objective and very rational in that way. But it's very much a misnomer to think of that photography is objective truth, because from the very beginning of photography it was manipulated in some way, shape or form. May not have been manipulated in terms of the image construction, you know, how the image was produced, but the way the artist composed the image, the way that they focused on a subject, the subjects that they chose were often done to heighten a particular meaning or message or whatever. So from the very beginning of photography there has been an attempt to control what the final image was going to be.
I think we believe photography because the impact of photography on us as human beings has probably had, you know, a bigger impact than many other art forms. I mean, for the first time we could actually see reality. We could see what each of us was looking at, you know, and I think for a while we got drunk on looking at ourselves. And that's really ingrained. Photography equals a kind of a mirror. But it's definitely, you know, ever since photography was first invented, we continued to tinker away with it. We've continued to kind of play around with it and invariably, you know, change it to suit ourselves and make it do things that we want it to do. And I think also we all have a practical kind of relationship to photography in that we've each taken photographs of each other, you know, at family events, etc., taken it to the shop and it comes back and it just looks exactly as, you know, we remember taking it. And then at some point, you know, people were, like Hurley, were playing around with that image and changing it to suit a particular idea, I suppose. And we haven't been able to remove ourselves from that, you know, taking our film down to a chemist and it coming back and it being what we expected.
I think that it's true, just that, what you said about the way we remember things is when we cast our minds back, you know, if I were to ask everyone here and out there listening to, you know, think back to your 10th birthday party, what you're doing is that you're visualising, you're trying, and so our memories are visual. And if you go to a concert today, you know, no one's looking at the people on stage, they're looking at their handphones while they record, so that they've got a memory. And I think, you know, that it's that there's some part of that is that we are visual creatures, and that's why visual images tend to be truth.
Okay, we'll leave our discussion of truth and photography there. Now we'll move on to what's on at WPCC. Kent, can you tell us a bit about the Goya install?
Yeah, this week we're installing an exhibition by Francisco de Goya, which is on loan from the Albury Regional Gallery. It's a series of 80 etchings by Goya produced in the 18th century. And that body of work is probably one of his most famous in terms of his work that critiqued Spanish society at the time. And that body of work is called Los Caprichos. And this week we will be installing that in readiness for the opening on Friday night.
Great, thank you. Jess, how's progress with On the Sly?
Progressing very well. We're reaching the final countdown, so to speak, for the exhibition. So it's just pulling together all of the resources now into a narrative for people to be able to come to the exhibition and look at. We had a great pre-introduction to the exhibition with the Lunchbox series of talks last week that was very successful and I think has really piqued people's interest in the show, which hopefully will be very successful.
Excellent. I'll just briefly mention the Education Resource Centre. We had a successful media launch last Friday. And commenced our intake of items connected to the Dubbo High School. We've had a few boxes of items come in already this week and hopefully more will be arriving over the next few weeks. The last segment for this podcast is what's happening elsewhere. These are things that have taken our interest over the past couple of weeks.
I'm kind of interested in the death to analogue. We're living in an increasingly digital world and certainly over the last sort of 6 months we've seen the death of Kodachrome. Kodak is no longer producing that film. In England, we're seeing the sort of the death of 16mm movie film. Companies are no longer printing that film. And I think it's interesting because we're increasingly seeing these analog art forms or analog forms in our society sort of fall by the wayside with people sort of throwing their arms up in the air and saying that, you know, that it's dying and what's the future and all these things that we've clinged to in the past are disappearing. I'm kind of interested what other people feel.
Well, I'm going to pass this straight back to Jess. I know that as the collections officer, in the back of house, we have a large number of typewriters.
Yes.
And, you know, I don't know who in their day-to-day life now would actually use a typewriter. Are we actually missing anything from the death of the typewriter as anything other than an object to be looked at with curiosity?
I don't think we're missing anything from our daily lives or the experience of going on a typewriter. But it's another thing to say we aren't using these things in our day-to-day lives, but we are keeping them and we are recognising their significance and their importance and their value. I think if we were to lose analogue completely, in the sense that we can never look at it again, we can never make anything from analogue ever again, like if it was all being wiped off the face of the earth, that would be something that we should be fighting against. But I don't think that that's what's happening. I think simply it's going through a phase of being unpopular. And, you know, in a 50, 100 years' time, when we pull out these dusty 16mm films and play them, people will be in awe of them as, wow, I've never seen this before. Well, I'm going to get interested in this. I'm going to research. So I don't think it is something to necessarily be terrified of. But it simply is another stage in human evolution, in the sense that we've moved on from that form of technology and we've kind of gone off in a different direction, and we may come back and visit it one day.
Well, there's always going to be, and I think there's always going to be people who do collect. You know, we've had, you know, sort of solid-state transistors in our hi-fi and amplifiers and CD players for decades now, and yet there are still people who insist on the old vacuum tubes and so on. But one thing that interests me about that is, say, if you want to buy a vacuum tube amplifier for your hi-fi set, it's going to cost you a bomb. I know that, Kent, we were talking earlier about, you know, that Kodachrome has, you know, you said they've shut down, but then someone has bought up all of their Polaroid stock and they're now introducing Polaroid cameras at $150, where, you know, you can get a disposable or a semi-disposable digital for $50 or $60. I'm concerned, I'm interested in, Kent, what you have to say. Are we just moving, is it not dying, but is it just moving to those who have a lot of money to be able to keep it alive?
Well, I think what's happening is that it's moving to the periphery. I think that what we're seeing is a shift in terms of pre-existing modes of production. I think what prevailed as the kind of thing that everyone used is now changing. So, you know, a good example of that might be, you know, the way that the book is evolving from something that people worship, this object that, you know, was full of words, and we're now seeing a kind of a reliance on screens and digital production, etc. I think what we're used to is now changing, and I think that it'll still be there. I think it will just be there in a diminished capacity. If you observe the music industry in particular, you'll see that, you know, the pillars of the music industry being the record labels are dying very slowly, to a point where I don't think that they will exist. They will never exist as they were ever again. And one could argue that, you know, if we look back through time, you know, those things crumble and something else rises to take its place. And I think we're in the middle of, very much in the middle of that. I think what we'll see is that the things that we all have taken for granted, like books, records, CDs, etc., will become a lot more specialised, a lot more attractive, I suppose, to those people who, you know, have loved them and continue to want them, etc. I think, in my mind, the buzzword for the future is bespoke. I think that we will change things to suit ourselves. We will, you know, we may be really interested in books. We may continue to buy books, but we may choose to buy them from Amazon and have them printed just for ourselves. I think that there's a lot that's happening in the world, and we're all sort of basically trying to deal with those changes.
And what about the speed with which this is going to happen? It's interesting you mentioned the CD, because when the CD came out, it was seen as a very poor imitation of the LP, you know, because the LP was in a sense, it's strictly analog, you know, little grooves. And the fact that you didn't get sort of the hiss and the pop and the crack every now and again was seen as horrible. You know, if you couldn't hear the, you know, the person coughing in the background of the concert hall, then there was something wrong with that, you know. You know, now you look at the way that the CD is now falling by the wayside. You know, we had the rise of the DVD. Now we've got the Blu-ray. The Blu-ray seems to be almost a doomed thing from the start because it's going to be online delivery. And then pretty soon those copper wires are going to fail and it's just going to be wireless delivery. And then, you know, the idea of people actually sitting around and watching a movie together will be stupid because you'll all be in separate rooms with your iPad or whatever. How, you know, this, it seems to be we're on some sort of like a wheel, like a hamster. It's just getting quicker and quicker and quicker. How can we collect, and I don't know if Jess wants to come in here, I know we're running out of time, but as a collection agency, things are disappearing in a sense so quickly now. How can we make the decision to what to collect and what not to collect?
I think it's a very difficult decision to be making, you know, as these formats are changing so rapidly. It's very difficult to decide, okay, well, we're going to collect things on Blu-ray because that's going to be the way, but then we find in 5 years time it's gone, that kind of thing. But I don't necessarily think that we need to be collecting things because they won't exist or they'll move. We'll move past them and they won't exist anymore. I think we should be focusing on collecting things that are game changers, that shift how, for example, obviously this generation values portability in terms of how it values things that they can, so they can bring their entire life with them in one device, kind of thing. So in a sense, that has changed from, you know, the sort of communal experience to an individual experience. So that is a game-changing moment that we collect the material that relate to that, but we don't necessarily have to collect every example of that new form. So I think it's about deciding how things have changed and what best signifies that change, rather than seeking to collect every format of everything that happens to be coming out at the moment.
I think we also are victims to, you know, industry, in the sense that, you know, if, again, to look at music, if we go back to the different formats from, you know, from the moment we were able to reproduce it mechanically, there's been a number of different formats over that time, and we've become slaves to whatever, you know, prevailing format there is, and it just happens that CDs have sort of lasted for quite a long time. But I think at the end of the day, I think we're all wise to the fact that CDs as a format aren't satisfying to a point. I think that people are wanting less compression. They want to hear exactly what it should sound like, which has sort of seen people wanting to return to vinyl. But in an MP3 world, which is massively compressed, that may be a different case in point. But I think that, yes, I think you're right, Tess, that everyone will, you know, have a stab at creating a format that everyone wants, and which ones actually take off and which ones don't is for history to decide.
Okay, we'll leave that very interesting topic there. Thank you, everyone, for joining us.
Thank you.
That concludes our first podcast session from the Western Plains Cultural Centre. Thank you, everyone, for listening.